Welcome to the For the Church podcast, another great gospel-centered resource from Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. My name is Jared Wilson. I'm an assistant professor of pastoral ministry and author in residence at Midwestern Seminary. And I'm here, as always, with my friend and my colleague and my co-host, Ross Ferguson.
That's me.
And it's a special episode today, not just because it's a mailbag, but also because why?
It is our 100th episode together.
Yes, number 100. We made it. We're centenarians. Yeah. So
it's all over now.
My friend, my colleague, my co-host, and my centenarian.
Oh, there you go.
Centenarian. I don't know. Is that what
it doesn't quite flow, though.
Centenarian, I think, is what it is. The 100th episode together. Can you believe that?
I feel a distinct privilege because I think with Ronnie Kurtz, you did maybe 50, 51 or something like
sure.
that.
Yeah,
I
yeah.
remember hearing an episode that you did 50 and I think, whoa, we've done 100. That's been 2.5 years.
Yeah. It doesn't, for some reason, it doesn't feel that long. Does it feel like 100 episodes to you?
Not really. No, okay. But.
Well, I would say when I was recording with Ronnie back in the day, we would not do 4 or 5 episodes at a time.
Yeah.
We usually did like 2, 3 maybe.
Yeah.
And I was also at that time doing more guest episodes.
Yes.
So we were alternating.
Yeah. So you weren't seeing him as much.
Yeah, I wasn't seeing him as much. So once we moved to sporadic guests and mostly you and I, we really started racking up those episodes. Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure.
100. It's been a pleasure. I'll get the little note in the door tomorrow along the lines of, it's been a pleasure, but no thank you. We're moving on to someone else.
There's some
other talent in the wing.
You have to get yourself fired from this thing.
I mean, that's a possibility. I can make that. I can do that.
Okay. Well, make that your New Year ambition.
My New Year ambition.
Get fired from the For the Church podcast. Well, aside from it being our 100th episode together, it is a mailbag episode. We've got some good submissions, and we're still pulling from the email.
Mm-hmm.
So no more social media. Maybe we'll go back to social media after a while. And so I should just say on the front end, if you would like to submit a question for the mailbag, please send it to mailbag@ftc.co. Did I say that right?
Yep.
Mailbag@ftc.co. And we'll sort through those questions. You can send them at any time. You don't have to wait for my social media prompt. You can send one right now for the next mailbag episode. All of these come from email. Question number one, this comes from Joel. Joel says, what are your thoughts on adding members to a congregation? Well, it's a good thing, Joel, adding members to a congregation. No, he says more. He says, do you subscribe to a membership class which teaches the beliefs of the church, mission statement, covenant, etc., or a form of discipleship and mentorship or something completely different? The church I attend implemented a contract of sorts for new member applicants to sign before being voted on by the church several years ago, but we are now trying to get away from it and steer toward more intentional discipleship. How, essentially, membership process is what Joel is asking about.
Yeah.
How do you process church membership? The first thing I thought of in response to Joel's question is, I'm not sure what he means by intentional discipleship as distinct from a membership class. And I don't know that this is an either or kind of thing.
I think maybe he's thinking like one-to-one, you know, walking alongside a church
so
leader
in a class with a group.
You just do it smaller. Here's my thing. Church membership, good, yes. Should it be a class or should it be more one-to-one, one-to-couples? I think that's up to your decision. I like a class. I like a standardized class so that everyone has exactly the same kind of entry knowledge. For us as a church, we've been accepting quite a lot of members this year. We've had a lot, and they're almost coming in batches of 10, 15 at a time. So for us, a class is better at Liberty. But you might be in a small church where you're doing just one person at a time. That might be better to just, you know, 5 Sunday evenings, you go to the pastor's house for dinner and you work through the class material one-to-one. The contract thing is an interesting one because as a covenant membership at Liberty, we actually do sign that we have gone through the class and we sign the piece of paper that we are in agreement with all of the doctrinal positions that we hold as a church. But it's not really contract-esque. It doesn't feel like a contract. It more feels like an agreement. So that, you know, I'm signing to agree. So I'm personally not wary of signing something on a dotted line. I think you're never really going to use that signature really for church discipline or anything like that. Because if you're kind of signed, sealed, delivered, becoming as a member, you're probably not going to have to go back to quote a contract to come to an agreement. but yeah. you hope it's the covenant they're agreeing to. So for me, it's a yes, have membership as whatever that process that looks best for your church. I think a class works. I think one-to-one works. I think you have to have a process. Can't just be this chap stands up and says, I want to be a member. Are yeah. you a Christian? Yes. Okay. You're in.
Awesome. You're in.
Yeah. There needs to be a process to it. I think it's great you've got church voting on a membership. Remember, the church holds the keys to who is in yep. and who is not in the kingdom. Outside of that, I think there's a lot of what kind of works for your church.
Yeah. Yeah, like you, I agree that the Bible gives us essentially the outline of church membership as a congregational right privilege. The church holds the keys, and so they receive members, vote members in, and release members as well. Beyond that, your protocol, your method, your yeah. process, I think we've got some open-handedness there. Mm-hmm. We can sort of, church to church, context by context, what seems wise or prudent. I have pastored churches where there was not a formal class that was, I met with the prospective member myself, conducted the interview myself, and then presented them to the congregation myself. The present process at Liberty Baptist Church is a little more extensive than that. We have a class that runs for successive weeks.
It's really good.
And if it's a set, as you said, curriculum, there's a standard, that works through the doctrine of the church, that works through the covenant of the church, expectations of the church, and even just like basic gospel stuff as well. So when someone applies, essentially they want to be a member, they sign up for the new members class.
Yeah.
And at the end of that, you don't automatically, become a member. You don't even have to continue pursuing membership. But you attend the class. Once you are through the class, there is an application form. And it just asks, when you say application, it just asks for your testimony. What are the evidences in your life that your life has changed since Christ? Those sorts of things. Why did you come to Liberty Baptist? Why do you want to be a member of Liberty Baptist specifically? Those sorts of things. And then there's a pastor who will follow up with each prospective member to conduct a pastoral interview. Once we have those interviews completed, we gather as pastors to present to each other. Each pastor says, I met with so-and-so last week, and here's how it went, and I'm recommending that we approve them to be presented to the congregation. We all trust each other, and so, based on those meetings, and we've had, even very recently, we've had pastors who have said, yeah, I met with so-and-so. I'm not convinced that they're a believer. Yeah. I think we want to, continue working with them, so I don't think they're ready to present quite yet. But for the most part, we gather, we say, I met with them, went great, here's how the conversation went. And then if all the pastors are in agreement, at the next members meeting, we present, the pastors recommend that we welcome so-and-so into church membership by transfer of letter from a previous church or by profession of faith. They're going to be baptized, mm-hmm. Pending baptism, et cetera. Congregation votes, and we welcome them in.
Yep.
That's kind of a long process. It's a more regimented process, I suppose. I don't think it's overly complex, but it's fine. But your church may not need something that extensive,
And there's always areas for rooms of improvement. So like I've often wondered, do we need to do a post-membership class of explaining, this is the depths of our budget. This is how we do Robert's Rules and members meetings, and almost like a practical, now you are a member, let's help you be a really good member type thing. And just a note on the membership class, we treat everyone the same in that membership class. So, I've been a Christian, well over 20 years, served in ministry for 10 years. I still remember sitting across from Dr. Tyler Sikora and he going, okay, Ross, what is the gospel?
Yeah.
And I remember just going, I'm really glad that you're not just assuming, because I've been a pastor, that I know how to explain this. So I think that's the beauty of a class, is everyone is treated as if they're the same. So we have the same foundational understanding. So if you're going to be doing one-to-one, that might be just something to keep in mind, is how do I make sure I cover all the same bases with each individual?
Yeah. And we have a form that we use in the interview. In the personal interview, that's pretty standard. So each pastor who's meeting with different people, we have a questionnaire that lists like four or five things that, we're going to ask, what is the gospel, et cetera. Now, we ask more than that as we get to know the person. So I usually sit down and just, want to know their background, their story, et cetera. But there are things that we're all, that we're each asking every person we interview, so that there is a standardized approach to it. Good question, Joel. Thank you so much for that. This comes from Anonymous. Anonymous asks, should pastors tithe or give back to their church from their salary they receive from the church? Do you view this giving as required, a good practice, or not required? I feel like there's a story behind this question, which is why he wants to be anonymous. But
I want to say yes. Yeah. Yes, they should be doing it. I'm going to just qualify a little bit. Should they tithe? Should they give back to their church?
Yeah, I'm assuming he doesn't mean like a literal tithe. I think he just means you're giving from your income.
Let's not put percentage on it. Let's just say, yes, they should be giving to their church. As a general rule of thumb, I have encouraged it as good practice. I would not want to be saying requirement unless it's part of your church covenant. If your church covenant is to say that all members of this church will give regularly, then of course that should also be the case for the pastor as well. He is also a member. But in terms of saying you must, we must see from your salary X amount of dollars coming to the church, or we're even going to do it for you. I've heard of churches doing it for them. It's good practice for all church members, including the pastor, to give to the church. General rule, I would do it to a general fund. So it's not specific. So it can't ever be seen that the church, the pastor's maybe like propping up a ministry.
He's giving directly to the pastor's book fund.
Yeah, exactly. So yes, as a general, I would encourage it. Just one slight thing, and then that's probably my whole view. We were in a church that had a very large budget. The general coffers did not need extra, if you will, but our missionary budget was very low. So in agreement with our treasurer, we put our entire giving into missions as a pastor. And that was just me going, I see behind the curtain, I kind of know what's happening. Yeah. I'm still giving, but actually let me help the church out by making sure it's going in this direction type thing.
I'm not sure what the impetus behind this question is. I can think of a couple of things. One is maybe you don't get paid very much. So the church isn't paying me a whole lot. Am I still expected to give back to this church? Yeah.
Or is it weird that they're giving me money and I'm giving them money back?
Yeah, or that's the other thing is sort of like they're giving me this money's coming from the church and I'm going to give money directly back to the church. Yeah. Doesn't seem to make much sense. It's kind of illogical. Either way, brother, yes, I would borderline on required, not necessarily a percentage per se, but the Lord loves a cheerful giver. I think generosity of heart is required for us. You know, if you expect your people to give, and pastors are meant to set an example for the flock, I think we need to set the example. We need to be good leaders and lead in by example in this area. I don't think that means you need to give a certain set amount if that's troubling or problematic for you or disadvantageous for you. But what, the amount that you have set aside in your heart, in clean conscience before God. But I do think you need to give to the church, if only to begin, avoiding the kind of hypocrisy. You expect your people to give no matter what they're earning, I suppose. In general, maybe there's specific folks that you're like, you know what, that person's really struggling. I'm not upset that they're not giving it. But, as a leader, you want to set the example in generosity, but for your family as well. And then just as a matter of trust before the Lord.
Yeah.
You may think this is a weird formality or illogical thing that the church is giving money, that I'm giving money directly back to the church. But don't think of it that way. Think of it as sort of like a means of worship, an act of worship. Regardless of where you receive your income from, to be able to, sacrifice, to be able to give, back to the church. I think it's a good thing. Again, if we knew more details about the reason for the question, maybe we could say more, but we would both say baseline, good practice.
Yes, do it.
Good practice, yep. Timothy says, are there any struggles that are unique to the church in the Northeast? And he means in the Northeast United States. Timothy, yes. And I like that you said unique. And not necessarily that are more difficult or harder than, say, like the Bible Belt, that sort of thing. Some people have the impression that New England or the Northeast United States is harder than, say, the suburban South. I would say it's a different kind of hard. I think it just depends on how you're wired for ministry. The unique struggle, I think, is that you just have less church background people in the Northeast. It's been a longer time since culture was Christian in the Northeast. So whereas you may be trying to evangelize a lost person in the South who still has some Bible knowledge because they went to Vacation Bible School or whatever it is, or they're just in a more Christian culture, they know the David and Goliath story and Daniel the Lion's Den or whatever. in the Northeast, it's more common to be evangelizing people who have zero, they have zero Bible knowledge. They don't know Adam from Adam. They don't know anything about the Bible. So in that sense, it's a unique struggle. You're starting a little further back. I don't think it's a harder struggle. I think it just depends on how you're wired for ministry, how you're wired to evangelize, contextualize, those sorts of things. I found it not necessarily easier, but more refreshing in New England than I did in Tennessee, for instance, or even Houston, Texas. But, you know, there are other folks that are like, man, I don't want to go up there. The soil's real hard up there. Yeah. But I found it more refreshing to minister among people who know what they don't believe rather than among people who think they believe something that they really don't. Mm. That's probably the primary unique struggle is just you have less Bible background. So you're kind of starting maybe with some apologetic sort of things a little earlier than you would in a more Christian culture. The other thing is just the weather can be harsher in the Northeast. You have harder winters, longer winters. So that in and of itself, you know, if you're asking about sort of the personality, temperament of the people, I don't know if that's a struggle. I think it's somewhat overblown that Northeasterners aren't friendly. There are certainly unfriendly people up there, just like there are unfriendly people in the South and the Midwest and every other place. So it just depends on, you know, where you feel like is your context. I don't know. I mean, they're not the same. I wouldn't say they're the same. But there is some overlap between sort of Northeast United States and where you come from.
Yeah, I was about to say, as you were describing
kind
this.
Kind of a post-Christian
kind of sounds it because I would say Scotland, so Wales and Northern Ireland, two countries in the UK, they're more Christian, more traditional, if you will. But Scotland and England, man, it's hard to find a good gospel church. Now, when you do find them, they're usually thriving and really flourishing and they're doing great ministry. But the ground is rock solid hard. Yeah. And, you know, it will not be hard to find families who have never stepped foot in a church. It will not be hard to find children who have never heard the name Jesus. Very similar. And also, very similar climate as well in terms of weather, in terms of environment and finances and all these sorts of things. So,
yeah
if you like the Northeast here, go to the UK.
I mean, you know, you kind of reminded me of maybe another unique struggle is just there aren't as many churches.
Yeah.
It's, you know, so maybe a fellowship or just inter-fellowship partnership collaboration may be more difficult sometimes too. You know, when you feel like you're in the trenches with a smaller number of people, that can be for some, they can feel lonely, they can feel alienated in some ways. Growing a church is a different thing. It's not likely, depending on the area. I mean, the Northeast is, I mean, I'm broad brushing here because, you know, there's just so many different regions and areas and even exceptions to this. But in general, you know, churches in the Northeast tend to be smaller than churches in the suburban South in the Bible Belt. Yeah. So there's fewer mega churches. If you're growing a church, you should not expect, you know, that you're going to grow, you know, to the thousands. And, you know, again, there are exceptions, but in general, like, you know, where I was in Vermont, I think at the time, the largest church in the state, I think this has changed in the last 10 years, but the largest church in the state was under 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And that was a big exception. Most churches in the state were probably 30 people, something like that, 30, 40.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're just looking at a different kind of church landscape. Yeah. And that can be a struggle if you're used to lots of resources, lots of people, lots of collaboration. It's just a different kind of thing. So, Timothy, thank you for the question. This next one, we've received numerous questions over the last number of months, over the last year, including more recently in the most recent submissions that are all about small groups. And so instead of just taking one of those, I thought you and I could just kind of banter around for a little bit on small groups.
Yep.
And we did we do an episode on small groups? On
a small group? We did pet peeves on small groups.
Okay, something like that.
Yeah.
But in general, do we have thoughts on
church
small groups?
I think they often are good, but they're maybe not as good as many people think they are. So there's a big movement that says, let's get everyone in a small group. That's the way to go. If everyone's in a small group, then we're doing community together. And actually, it probably isn't as succinct and as good as you're thinking it is. Yeah. Life is busy. Bringing people together regularly, that's hard. Here's a couple of good thoughts on it. Number one, small groups is a great time to exercise being a church family together in a smaller setting. I think you should be less rigid as to what occurs in that.
Yeah.
Because as you're bringing people together, say on a Wednesday night or Tuesday night, whatever, I think just coming together, getting to know each other, finding out how each other's week has been, having a meal together, knowing each other's children, serving one another, celebrating birthdays and births and marriages, just doing that on a kind of a smaller scale is a really good thing. So I've led small groups for years. I led one at Liberty for a couple of years as well. I concentrated way more on the fellowship side, way more on the interpersonal relationships than I did on deep Bible study. Because here's the reality is, actually, if we're caring for one another, guiding one another, living together, quote, in community together, then we're going to be encouraging Bible knowledge as a church family. Coming together for an hour and 30 minutes to do a deep Bible study, honestly, I don't think that's the most effective way of doing small groups. I think there can be times and places for that, but I think the most effective way is really coming together in practicing out the church covenant in a smaller setting.
Gotcha.
That would be my advice. The second thing I would say is should be all ages. I'm a big believer in not having a young adults group, an older member group, a families group, this location group. I'm a big believer in everything. So in our small group at Liberty, we had, I think the oldest was 82, and then we had babies. You know, we had and everything in between. We had people that work in secular environments, Christian environments, homeschool, Christian school, public school. You know, we just mixed it all together because that's what the church is. The church is just a big mix of people. And so I think the small group should be a reflection of what the church is as well.
I've always loved that. This is kind of a side note, and I guess it's related to small groups, but in our equipping groups at Liberty for, you know, since we've been there, as I recall, there are not age segregated classes. No.
There's one for teenagers, and that's about it.
Yeah, there's a youth class. And so when I say equipping groups, think Sunday school if you're listening to this. So your Sunday school. Ours are sort of topical, you know. There's a class on the New Testament, or there's a class on, you know, sharing Christ in your workplace, or there's a class on, you know, what have you. And, you know, if you're teenage and up, you can attend any of those classes. So there is a youth class, as you said. But I remember, like, my girls didn't attend the youth class. Yeah. They went to the, you know, adult Sunday school classes. And I love that. See, in fact, there was one Sunday I snapped a picture. It comes up in my Facebook memories, you know, every year. I snapped a picture on a Sunday morning of my daughter, Grace, who at the time was probably 15, I think, sitting next to Bill and Shirley Mulligan, who were older members of our church. And I just thought, this is such a beautiful picture, of a 15-year-old sitting next to an 80-year-old in the, you know, in a Sunday school class. Two things on small groups that I would note. Number one, very few churches do small groups well. I think it's kind of the dirty little secret.
Yeah.
Everyone's trying to crack the code on small groups. Almost nobody does them like really, really well. And people are always trying to reinvent how they do them. And I think part of the problem is, the other thing that I would say is, you have to decide what they're for.
Yeah.
Decide ahead of time. This is what this is for. This is the problem small groups are solving. Because you can't
do everything.
Yeah, you can't do everything. What they become is like this stew of ambition. We want to solve the community problem and the Bible study problem and the reaching our neighbors problem. And so it's going to be a missional Bible deep teaching fellowship
meal
thing. Yeah. And it becomes everything and it doesn't work. And it's only sustained for so long. You've got to be nimble, adaptable. You've got to figure out what is like the one thing that this is supposed to solve or what they're supposed to do. So you don't burn out leaders, so that they're clear on what you're trying to do with them. That, to me, I think has been the biggest issue. And you may need to change. When I first went to my last church, I didn't need small groups for fellowship or community because I had a small church in a small town. They were all up in each other's business all the time anyway. There was not a problem of community to be solved. So in the beginning, it was, let's reinforce Bible teaching. They need some more discipleship in this environment. So let's do that. Over time, as our church grew, and especially as we began to draw people from outside of our little town, we had to shift. Okay, let's start doing meals and just have it more fellowship. Yeah. So, you know, we'll have intentional spiritual conversation around that meal, but let's make it more about a community thing. So, you know, you just need to decide, this is what it's for and this is what we're going to do.
You can also go backwards. So at Liberty, we had small groups.
And we moved to a prayer service.
Currently, we've gone to a prayer service. And it was just, we felt the need of the church and felt the almost the desire as well of the church. And we stopped small groups for a period of time. I think just don't pin all your hopes on small groups will resolve.
Yeah.
It will help, hopefully, but it might not resolve.
Yeah, that's good.
Midwestern Seminary is pleased to announce the launch of FTC Talks. FTC Talks presents the opportunity to hear from Midwestern Seminary professors about their area of expertise and asks them any questions you want. It's completely online and it's free. We have an array of FTC Talks scheduled for the spring, including a talk on gospel-driven ministry with myself and Midwestern's preaching professor, Dr. Jared Bumpers. That's on March 26th at 12 p.m. What does the gospel have to do with pastoral ministry? Is there a particular way to pastor that is gospel-centered? In this FTC talk, Dr. Bumpers and myself will discuss gospel-centered ministry and everything from pastoral health and pastoral care to how to know when your ministry veers off track. Not only will you be equipped to minister the gospel from a place of health through this conversation, but you'll also receive personal encouragement from men who have practiced gospel-centered pastoral ministry for decades. We hope you'll join us for this special conversation. It's March 26th at 12 p.m. There'll also be a time for Q&A so we can interact with you. You can learn more about all of the FTC talks and sign up to participate in these free resources by going to mbts.edu/FTC talks. That's mbts.edu/FTC talks.
This comes from Justin. Justin says, I've been a part of SBC churches my whole life, but in recent years, a member of a much more traditional Baptist church. Our leaders this year have been running a stewardship campaign. I've never been a part of one of these. I'm curious about your thoughts on the scriptural basis for these, as well as how you've potentially seen them done well and not so well.
Stewardship meaning raising funds.
They're raising funds for a particular purpose. So we're going to have a campaign over a period of time to raise money to buy land, buy a building, pay off our debt, something.
I mean, I have two very simple thoughts on it.
Yeah, me too.
It's fine to do them. That's my first simple thought.
Yeah.
Sometimes we have this, certainly in the UK. So this is a big thing in the UK. You don't talk about money in the UK. No one talks about money.
Oh, interesting.
It's like very much not done in public. How does the church know what the need is if you don't actually talk about what the need is? So sometimes it might just be, hey, we need to raise $5,000 to help this missionary out for the next 4 weeks, special giving. Or it might be, we both have been to a church, visited a church where they had $1.5 million worth of debt because of a massive building. And they said, right, this year we're going to pay it off and we're going to just do this. So I think sometimes, yep, great. Here's my second thought. Beware of burning out people's giving.
Yeah.
Sometimes, so this is very common. My mother actually worked for a university and she did a lot of this in terms of building projects at university. After you've done this massive project and let's say you've paid off the roof or whatever, people don't really want to hear about the next giving thing. They've just given you all that they kind of had. You need to give them a bit of a break.
Yes.
If you're on this treadmill of constantly, we need to be giving for this and giving for this and giving for this, as in multiple stewardship campaigns, bear in mind you're going to burn out the church's giving and they're going to feel resentment over that. So be wise as to what you're asking for. And use it sparingly. So, you know, we're in a moment at Liberty where we're thinking about church expansion, build, refurbish, buy. We don't know yet. We have not yet started really asking the church for giving to that because we want to have a set plan, I assume, a set plan. And then when we do, if we do want to do that process, we don't really want to ask them for seven different things.
Yeah.
This is the target we're looking for. So yeah, I'm all for it, happy to do it. I don't think, I can't think of anything as I'm sitting here that would be unbiblical to say to the church family, we have this bill coming up or we have this expense. Can we come together over the next 6 months to get this covered? I can't think of anything off the top of my head that would negate that biblically.
Yeah.
Maybe an overemphasis on just pray about it and the Lord will provide. So maybe, but that might be an overemphasis. But just be really careful of burnout stuff. Remember, this is hard-earned cash from people. And if you're constantly asking for it, it can breed bitterness.
I think that's good advice just generally too in terms of a leadership pace that you don't lead a big initiative right after another big initiative that's not a push, whether it's a stewardship campaign or other, that you don't have some huge emphasis or leadership change or something that you're doing, that you can have, you can you know, give your church kind of a change fatigue.
Yeah.
You need to give them some time to recover and recuperate. The biblical basis for some of these things, I mean, you don't see, obviously, in the New Testament, you know, saving up money to buy a building or add on to a building and those sorts of things, which could cause some today to see like, oh, they didn't even have this kind of stuff in the New Testament. What are we even doing? Yeah. But I don't think that means it's unbiblical to use, you know, funds in this way, if that's right for your church. But you do see fundraising to be able to fund mission.
Yeah, like
you
do Apostle see, Paul was
yeah, they're gathering money and sending the money across. Even in the Old Testament, there may be, you know, times of special offering, you know, those sorts of things. So you've got sort of a, I wouldn't say tenuous biblical basis, but even if you don't have a one-to-one correlation with what we see is like, oh, they got the thermometer out and you, I don't know if you've ever seen that where they have the thermometer raise the, you know, this is how much money we need left and the reds keep going up.
Yeah.
But I think it's fine. Another bad way to do it is where the entire church's focus is on
just
this
on that
thing and not on Jesus.
Yeah.
So you need to be careful that the stewardship campaign, you know, does not become all-encompassing where the whole mission of the church is this stewardship campaign and not making disciples, that the whole focus is the stewardship campaign and not the glory of Jesus Christ, that the whole focus is raising money and not on preaching the gospel.
Yep.
If every sermon is about this thing, like those are things to be to be careful about.
Also agree on how you're going to do it. So I know some churches would not like to do bake sales and would not like to do tombolas or whatever you're doing.
What is that?
Tombola?
Tombola, what is that?
You get little tickets and then you buy a ticket and then you see what you win.
This is not an American thing. It sounds like a raffle.
A raffle.
Oh, okay,
yeah, a raffle. But
okay.
It's called a tombola.
Tombola. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Good education. But decide what you are and are not willing to do as a stewardship campaign.
Yeah. I mean, it was so, I remember a church I was a part of in Nashville before I planted. It was so gross. They were building, it was called the Crazy Campaign. They were trying to raise a crazy amount of money for, I think a children's wing, I think was what it was. And you know, it was just, you know, legitimate need, I suppose. But they had, you know, they booked out the arena downtown to fill it up with people to do a fundraiser. And the pastor drove up onto the stage on his Harley Davidson. And it was such a spectacle. Everything was about this thing. That's just a gross, idolatrous way to go about it. Yep. So anyway, hope we answered your question well, Justin. This comes from Scott. Scott says, my question is about using quotes during sermons. In my sermon, I could say, Jared Wilson, and he misspells my name, but anyway, if you're going to quote me, at least spell my name right, Scott. Jared Wilson makes this excellent point about gospel centrality, followed by the quote. Or I could restate Jared's point in my own words. How would you help pastors think through using quotes or and even who to quote in their preaching? Scott, I would say if you're beginning with somebody's quote and you just want to rephrase it, you're venturing into the world of plagiarism. It's one thing if you have your own thought and it happens to parallel somebody else's thought. But if you see a good quote and you decide, I don't want to quote that person, so I'm just going to rephrase it, you're still borrowing at best. And you should give credit.
Yes.
There's nothing wrong with giving credit.
Yeah, I'm in this world a lot from the seminary perspective in terms of writing. And I think the same principles goes across to preaching. Is this thought that you are sharing something you came up with without consulting anything? Or did something help you get to this? And there's so many ways. You don't even have to quote it. So you could rephrase it and you could say it like this. Jared Wilson was really helpful in me coming to the conclusion of. You're hinting to, I got this. Or in reading my commentary sets, the pillar set was really helpful in this. Or I really was trying to phrase this in a really good way. And I kind of came to this, and it was really helpful to read that to get it to. You're going to have to get used to phrasing it in a way that you're saying, this is not original to me, that I've got help from this. In terms of who to use, so I think, number one, use quotes sparingly. Remember, the work in the text should be your work in the text.
Yeah.
And really, you're going to others either to help you phrase something, and if that's the case, then and tell who you're getting help from, or correcting maybe something you got wrong in terms of your prep. So really, unless it's illustrations, I'm not looking at lots of quotes in. I think in a recent sermon I did two. I think in terms of who to use, I personally wouldn't use anyone that I'm aware of that has heretical views. I personally also don't use anyone that I'm aware of that has gone through moral failings. And if I am using them for any reason, for instance, you know, maybe someone doesn't share a strong view that I would share, I would be very clear. I don't really agree with this person on multiple areas. However, they have written well here.
Sure.
But yeah, my big no is don't use anyone that is obvious in the moral failing world.
Yeah. Or that would be, I suppose, distracting to your folks in some way.
It's they quoted that person? Yeah, really? Yeah. Don't use that.
It kind of detracts from even the point of the quote.
I'm not a fan of the quote dead guys thing of you only quote people that are dead. We've seen plenty of people that have been discredited after they've died. Like, I just don't.
Well, okay.
I'm kind of like, just be wise on who you choose.
Yeah. Well, I've been tired. I've gotten where I quote more dead guys in my books, especially because I'm just tired of getting burned by somebody. But in general, I can't think of a good reason, Scott, why you wouldn't cite.
Yeah.
There's nothing unwieldy about it. And people who are acting like you can't just say so-and-so said or as I read in a book by so-and-so or so-and-so wrote or as I heard from
you don't even have to use the name sometimes. Sometimes you can just say one commentator.
Yeah. You don't have to cite like the page number and the title and people who are acting like this is a huge deal to actually cite who they're getting things from in a sermon, it's the easiest thing in the world to give credit. If you see the quote, don't rephrase it and try to steal it. Just cite the person. Yeah. There's a 100 benefits besides. You're recommending good people to your folks. You're showing them that you study. Yeah. There's just all sorts of... There's no good reason not to do it.
If it helps, what I do in my manuscripts is I just put the person's name and put it in brackets after anything that I think is not original to me. And therefore, I have in my manuscript very clear understanding as to where I got this from. So even if somebody misheard me or I didn't, there's multiple times I've preached and I've missed out a line or something like that. Yeah, mistakes happen. It's fine. At least you're in your manuscript, you've got, hey, that wasn't me. That was this guy type thing.
Yeah. So. Okay. Final question. I think this one will be kind of short as well. This comes from Adam. Adam says, do you have any good recommendations for resources relating to church hospitality? I've begun to research scripture regarding the subject and am in the process of reading Rosaria Butterfield's The Gospel Comes with a House Key, but was interested in any other suggestions. Adam, this is a great question, if only because we focus in the Pastoral Training Center, at least for a month, on hospitality because it is it's part of the biblical qualifications for eldership. So we spend a whole month focusing on it. And the book, I'll let Ross speak to the helpfulness or lack thereof, but the book that our residents read is called Making Room by Christine Pohl. And Making Room is really more of almost like a historical survey overview. It comes into the contemporary world as well, but it's more of an academic treatment. That's one reason I picked it, because it's a little deeper, has more of the sort of biblical rationale, biblical roots of hospitality. Mm-hmm. And speaks of hospitality, this is another thing I think, because today when people talk about hospitality, even in the church, they're often thinking about hosting, having a party, which I suppose is an aspect, but biblically, hospitality has to do with evangelism, welcoming the stranger, making space for those who are different than you, those sorts of things. And this book, Making Room by Christine Pohl, sort of highlights that aspect of it.
Yeah, I would say it's not a how-to book. Mm-hmm, it's not going to give you 10 steps to be good at hospitality. It's more of a why. Why should you be hospitable? And where have we seen good practices? I find it very challenging from the things that we would think we do. Oh, I open my home for a meal. And then the book is going, well, in this century, they were very common to just, the door was open for anyone to come and sleep at that nighttime if they needed it. And you're thinking, going, that's not going to happen in my eyes. So it's a really challenging look at making hospitality a way of life. I had that, and I have a second book. I don't know if you had a second book, but my second book was Carolyn Lacey's
Extraordinary Hospitality.
See, we're in agreement of two books. Extraordinary Hospitality for Ordinary People. That is a little bit more how to.
Yes.
I think it's seven ways or something like that. They have seven ways to show hospitality. Much lighter. You could read the book in.
It's from the Good Book Company. Yeah. And it's one if you're wanting to you can easily hand that out. Folks.
Yeah. You could read it in an hour to 2 hours type thing. The Making Room book, you're looking at several hours to read that book. But this is maybe a good little how to. Making Room by Christine would be great for maybe your elders, maybe your church leaders to read through and really think through. Extraordinary Hospitality, you could give that to every single church member for them to consider what it looks like to to be practicing hospitality on a daily basis. So that was Making Room by Christine Pohl, and then Extraordinary Hospitality for Ordinary People by Carolyn Lacey.
Excellent. All right. Hey, man, we got through.
We got through our 100th episode.
100th episode. Nice. And until next time, until the 101st episode, dear listener, please give us a good review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And until next time, may Jesus be big in your church.
You've been listening to the For the Church podcast, hosted by Jared Wilson, found online at ftc.co. This resource is brought to you by Midwestern Baptist Theological Seminary in Kansas City, Missouri, where we train leaders for the church.